Now, welcome to another inspiring edition of Sound Insight with Dr. Tom Curran.
Well, welcome to the program. This is Dr. Tom Curran. I'm here today with Dr. Anthony Lillis, and he is joining me, I think, from Southern California. Is that right, Dr. Lillis?
Actually, I'm up in the Bay Area, just across the bay from the peninsula, San Francisco and stuff.
Nice. Well, you know, so for us folks, California is just kind of this big amorphous type of reality. So,
yeah. So, yeah, L.A., that's where the Hollywood and all of that happens. And up where I'm at is where they make the computer chips, or Silicon Valley.
So that's so awesome. And Dr. Lillis, he's an author of several books. He's a professor of spiritual theology at St. Patrick Seminary in Menlo Park, and has had a very rich background in priestly formation, as well as in helping Catholics to pray by really mining the riches of our Catholic tradition, our spiritual tradition, and looking at mystical streams of teaching in our tradition, as well as in particular, also giving retreats and focusing in on Saint Elizabeth of the Trinity. I am really super excited to interview Dr. Lillis.
Hi, this is Dr. Tom Curran, and you know me as the host of Sound Insight. I am also letting folks know that as a realtor licensed in the state of Washington and in Idaho, I love serving Catholic families and others who are discerning a move for yourselves. It's much more than buying or selling a home. It's discerning a whole new life. If that's something that you would find a help in, if I could be of service to you, please be in touch. You can find out more at drtomcurran.com. drtomcurran.com.
Again, I'm talking with Dr. Anthony Lillis today. I'm just going to just dive right in. So I want to start with your Franciscan roots. You were at Franciscan University of Steubenville. That's where you got your bachelor's degree. And I just want to start with that. What ended up having you choose going to Franciscan University? And what were the blessings? What were the fruits of your being there?
Okay. Well, what happened was my first became aware of Franciscan University and decided that maybe that's where I wanted to go. I was in eighth grade, and we had a priest coming to our parish doing classes. He was pitching them at the undergraduate level for the college university young people at UC Santa Cruz. There was, at the same time he was doing that, there was a Eastern Orthodox monk who was teaching on the faculty there. And so there were, and it created the reason why UCSC let the Eastern Orthodox monk on was they had an East Asian religion program, and Orthodoxy is kind of, you know, an exotic East Asian religion, according to secularists at least. And he was causing the students to have a lot of questions. And so a whole group of students became interested in this priest, Father Jim Nesbitt, who would go to Steubenville conferences in the summer, would teach these biblical classes at the parish. And they were New Testament mostly. And I discovered even at eighth grade, I could keep up with the conversation. And I loved the conversation. I loved the whole world of theology and going deeper in our faith and finding those difficult to reach connections between the truths of our faith. And one day Father Jim Nesbitt said, one of the students was trying to trap him in a theological puzzle, and he threw down his pencil and he said, "There are no good universities left except in Steubenville, Ohio." And I decided that that was going to be the place I went, and eventually, I wound up there as a major in theology and never looked back.
That's amazing. I mentioned this in part because I have four of my kids are at Franciscan University right now. My wife is a graduate. She graduated in 91. So I'm not sure if she was there during the years you were there, if you were there a little bit earlier. But I'm going to bet we have some common connections.
Yeah, they're likely she was a freshman my senior year, and so we probably might have crossed paths, but So I'm glad to hear you've raised such a beautiful family, and that's the story of Steubenville, though. It catches you at the right time of life and helps you begin to ask the right kind of questions and to think about your faith on a much deeper, more profound level. The level that you need to for understanding as an adult to bear the weight of your existence, to answer the deep questions. And I'm glad your wife found that, and I'm glad your wife found you. What a beautiful family you have.
Well, you're very kind. In fact, Father, you have a very rich background in formation, seminary formation, priestly formation, still, again, for many years now on faculty at multiple seminaries in LA and, as you mentioned, Menlo Park and back in Denver. I'm going to throw another name out to you, see if you have a connection to him, because he was Franciscan University of Steubenville, and then he entered the seminary, became a priest for the Archdiocese of Denver, and then was involved at St. John Vianney Formation House there. His name's Father Michael Glenn. Yeah. I don't know if you remember him.
Father Michael Glenn and I were very close friends in Steubenville. We, after psychology class, we would lift weights together and cry about how difficult the exams were. Us and if he's listening, Joey Gerchen was with us too. Couple of the other guys. And Father Michael and I not only studied at Steubenville together, but we also studied in Rome together. And after some of our studies in Rome, I was sitting at a table in Rome of all Denver priests, and they said, wouldn't it be a great grace if someday you moved to Denver and became the academic dean of our seminary in Denver? And everybody laughed because it was such an impossible thing, you know. And not 10 years late after that conversation, I was the academic dean of St. John Vianney Seminary. I was on the founding faculty there, and Father Michael Glenn was my rector. And in the very early days of the seminary, we helped build it and shape it and strengthen it in so many ways. That seminary is successful because of the vision he gave. Most of all, though, I would have to say, I was with Father Michael in his last days and weeks. I wasn't with him when he died, but Father Glenn had an extraordinary love for the seminarians and for the priesthood. And that love, he wanted to see men thrive as priests, see men thrive in their fidelity to Christ through the priesthood. And he himself had a deep, honest relationship with the Lord. He wasn't afraid to just pour his heart out and where he was, and he taught men to pray the same way. And I think that's one of the reasons why the presbyterate in Denver is so strong, was the foundation that my friend Father Michael Glenn laid there.
That is so powerful. So let's kind of flesh out the story a little bit. I met Father Michael Glenn when he and I were flying to Rome together to begin our first year of theology study and seminary studies at the North American College. So we were classmates.
Wow. And so,
yeah. Yeah. And so, so here's the thing. He was one of two or three guys total in our class at the North American College. This was being now in the fall of 86, where there was an openness to the Catholic Charismatic Renewal and some level of contact and influence by the renewal. And so I found him to be such a beautiful brother in the Lord, not just a fellow seminarian, but going to the Gregorian University for those years. I was there for 3 years until 89. I finished the first cycle, and then I left the seminary and continued to serve the church. But one of the things that we did in our second and third year was we started a men's group in the seminary, if you can believe it. And it was based on the fact that he and I both, along with a couple of other guys that had backgrounds in either the Catholic Charismatic Renewal or Catholic Covenant Community, this sense of small group fraternity, the importance of being brothers together. And it became a place for us to be able to be supportive, encouraging, and accountable to each other, to discuss things that maybe would slip through the cracks or would be permitted to slip through the cracks in a more general seminary formation program. And so it grew. There was a total, I think, 15 or 16 of us out of the 120 guys at the seminary that got involved in these men's groups that we started in the seminary. Now, we got in trouble for it, but we got in trouble because there was this spirit that somehow we were like considering ourselves superior. And we're like, no, this is just the opposite. We know that we need each other to walk together as brothers in the Lord and not just as guys who happen to share a hallway in a seminary. And I can remember after he was ordained and then he went to Denver, how that, at least in part, his background in understanding men's households was a wonderful gift in helping to shape and mold this formation program there in Denver.
Yeah, well, no, exactly. And maybe three ways. He himself continued to be involved in priestly fraternal support groups all the way through his priesthood, as far as I'm aware. And the group in Denver he was with seemed to me to be based a lot like what you might call a Jesu Caritas group. They would spend maybe a day a month or every other week in prayer together and sharing fellowship and that also formed him in his early years there in Denver. When he became rector, he took your idea and married it to what was called the Paris model, where they instead of living in the big giant seminary, men lived in smaller communities in the local parishes and would pray together, kind of like you were describing was your experience at the NAC, North American College. But probably one of the more daring things he did along the lines of what you just described was he encouraged a group of young seminarians to get together in what would be known as the Companions of Christ. There's Companions of Christ in Minnesota, a group of fraternal priests in a fraternity together, and they kind of mentored this group down in Denver, but he was also intimately involved in trying to build the thing up and get the thing launched. And I think there's a lot more priestly fraternity in Denver because of these efforts that were made. And it involved, the charismatic renewal was at work in this. Not everybody, not all the priests in Denver are involved in the charismatic renewal, but the idea of the fellowship that the renewal brought to them, and the idea of with charismatic prayer, there's also an openness to contemplative prayer. And I think the priests in Denver definitely have a profound openness to contemplative prayer as a regular part of their priesthood. And again, that foundation that you and Father Michael Glenn experienced at North American College because your previous experience in the renewal, bore fruit. And I think the fruit is still ongoing. I think the next gen, all of Father Glenn's first seminarians and students, they're all leaders in that seminary now. And so it's been passed on to the next generation. And hopefully that spirit of renewal continues.
That's really powerful. I didn't get all of that unfolding in his life, the influence that he had, but I'm not at all surprised. He, again, a true man of God. And you might have heard Dr. Lillis mention before he died, he did die sadly after a battle with cancer. And as a younger man, right? He didn't reach the fullness of years. And I did have a chance to talk to him. It was a few months before he died. I think he was in hospice at the time. And I remember the blessing of that conversation with him, but you had the wonderful gift of walking with him for many years. in that seminary formation. And this is something that you've continued to do. I have to say, it's rare. So here you are, Anthony, feeling this call to be at the service of the church as a Catholic theologian. And I know that you probably did it because of the money.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a little joke right there. So, but it's a true vocation, the vocation of being a Catholic theologian. You're married, you have three kids, and yet you've continued to serve the Lord and the church in a variety of ways. And folks, I want you to discover the gift of Dr. Lillis. And you can do that by going to there's several different outlets and websites. He has probably the thing that he's best known for is a website that's called beginningtopray.com, beginningtopray.com. And I encourage you to go to that website, as well as to discover his podcast, Discerning Hearts, as well as three books that he's written. A book called Hidden Mountain, Secret Garden, which is a theological contemplation on prayer, Fire from Above, and Living the Mystery of Merciful Love, which is 30 Days with Thérèse of Lisieux. And I want to mine some of the insights that you have from these different sources, the podcast, the books, the online blog, and other places that you have. But you're also doing a retreat. So in addition to all of that, I don't know how you have time to come to Spokane, but I'm thrilled you're doing it. And you'll be here in just over a week, folks. He's going to be giving a weekend retreat for men and women on this gift of Saint Elizabeth of the Trinity. And I'm going to encourage you again to go to IHRC.net. IHRC.net is the Immaculate Heart Retreat Center.net, IHRC.net, and you'll see and we'll be able to sign up for this retreat, which we're going to dive into more fully.
Hey, this is Dr. Tom Curran, the host of Sound Insight, but also a realtor serving wonderful folks like you in the state of Washington and in Idaho. I've had the privilege and pleasure of helping dozens of families in the last 2.5 years discern and find a strategy, a path, and a plan to help their families find a whole new life in eastern Washington and northern Idaho. If I could be of service to you in that, I would love to. Please reach out, drtomcurran.com, drtomcurran.com.
So Dr. Lillis, I threw a whole bunch of stuff out there, but I have to just start with this entry point that you began at Franciscan, you got your doctoral degree from the Dominicans, and yet you have this rich and even worldwide level expertise of exploring and explaining the Carmelite tradition. What a rich background you have. And I have to ask, how did you go from the Franciscan spirituality to the Dominican? I'm sure being at the Angelicum in Rome for those years had a big impact on you. And then landing on and really exploring and mining Carmelite, especially the Discalced Carmelite tradition with John and Teresa Therese and then Elizabeth of the Trinity. What a journey.
Well, thank you for putting it all together like that. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but so much of this started at Steubenville, and again, I'm so grateful for the Third Order Regular Franciscans for that apostolate they have in that university. It was certainly a great foundation for me, but while I was taking classes there, there were a couple professors who really influenced me profoundly. One of them was a Dominican. His name was Father Giles Dimmick. And Father Giles, he was a Eastern Province Dominican, a liturgist and a spiritual theologian. And I took about every class I possibly could from Father Giles. And this led to a lot of conversations. So I was also in the founding household of the pre-theology program. The household was called Koinonia, and it was for young men discerning the priesthood, and we lived as if we were seminarians. And he was very involved in forming that. And anyway, one day he invited me to try the Dominicans out. And in the meantime, I had taken up with Garrigou Lagrange and some of the some of the 20th century Dominicans, and of course at that time, Augustine de Noia, now Archbishop, and several other, Gabriel O'Donnell, several other Dominicans were teaching at the House of Studies, and I thought, wow, this would be quite a gift to be able to study under these bright lights for our time, because they had clarity and they had vision for what was going on in the culture and in the church, and I thought this would be very important. But there was one more influence in my life from a completely complementary source, but also at Franciscan University, a certain Dr. Miravalli and Dr. Healy, one taught courses in phenomenology, and the other a class on John Paul II, the thought of John Paul II, and it was John Paul II. During this whole time was also extremely important. He was bringing hope into the church and making us feel good about being Catholic, and he had a sense that we needed to engage the world. So I was very interested in his spirituality, and I think it was Dr. Mark Miravalli noted that he had just beatified Elizabeth of the Trinity, and during the beatification said that Elizabeth of the Trinity was one of the most influential mystics in his own spiritual life. And it planted a seed, and I wanted to look into it. I also wanted to study John of the Cross, because John Paul II wrote his doctoral dissertation on the nature of faith in St. John of the Cross. And I'd already been reading Saint Thérèse of Lisieux and Teresa of Avila. And so it all kind of converged that I began my intellectual exploration and spiritual exploration of the Carmelite tradition, even before I tried the Dominicans as a novice, even while I was an undergraduate, and before I'd started any of my formal studies that would lead to my expertise I now have in Elizabeth of the Trinity. It really began there at Steubenville, and kind of the wonder in finding out about, St. Thomas Aquinas on the other hand, John Paul II, and the need for contemplative prayer in the church today. And that's what, I loved charismatic spirituality. I noticed sometimes when we prayed, there would be a moment during the prayer where a great silence would fall over everyone. And in that silence, you felt so humbled and so overcome by awe. And you wanted the silence to last forever. It was like a foretaste of heaven. And I had known that prayer earlier in my life. Even in high school, my freshman year, I'd spent a few days with the Kamal Dalis, and I tasted that same kind of awe in the silence of Big Sur. But here it was coming up in prayer, and then these Carmelites are writing about the same thing, and Garrigou Lagrange is writing about the same thing, and John Paul II, if you look very carefully at his writing, he keeps on holding it up again and again. He says he has no program. The program that he proposes to the church is not a formula, but a person, Jesus Christ. And contemplative prayer is all about welcoming Jesus Christ into the depths of our heart.
You know, Dr. Lillis, you said so much there. And I think of St. John Paul II, when he was still a student, he was, I think, formed by a lay person in the riches of the Carmelite tradition. I don't remember his name, but I think that was part of his formation, wasn't it?
Yeah, Jan Taranovsky.
That's right. Yes.
Jan had started out as an accountant, but switched over to becoming a humble tailor, because being a tailor was more in line with contemplative prayer. He himself was also a somewhat well-known essentialist philosopher, essentialist philosophers in Europe in the beginning of the 20th century were a group of people who believed that the world religions, they were attacking secularism and atheism, and they believed that the world religions had some essential insights. And so there were Catholic essentialists, and he was one of them. But through his philosophical studies, he too stumbled into St. John of the Cross. And then when the Nazis invaded Krakow, the priests were all in prison, and before they were put in prison, they commissioned Jan to form young people in the group called A Living Rosary. And he would use this rosary group to teach the teachings of John of the Cross and the other Carmelites. And Karol Wojtyła, a young acting student at the university there in Krakow, became part of that group. And hearing the teachings of John of the Cross, it led him to reconsider. He was involved in the resistance on a violent level, actually, and it led him to reconsider that pathway and to consider the possibility of pursuing the pathway of the priesthood. And that by itself, the fact that John of the Cross and his spiritual doctrine on contemplation can be an answer to communism, and actually look at what the answer it was, it eventually led to communism's downfall, what John Paul II experienced through contemplative prayer.
You know, Dr. Lillis, again, I'm talking with Dr. Anthony Lillis today, a wonderful gift to be able to have him be sharing so richly about not only his own background, but giving us insights into the Carmelite spirituality and the way that it has impacted great leaders and saints in our day, like St. John Paul II. He'll be coming up to the Spokane area and leading a weekend retreat. It begins on August the 8th and continues until the 10th. So that's Friday night, 6 o'clock in the evening until Sunday at 1. And the retreat is called Called to Glory, Spiritual Insights from St. Elizabeth of the Trinity. And I know a lot of folks have not heard of St. Elizabeth of the Trinity. And so I'm excited to dig into that with you further. But as a pathway into that, you talk about the importance of contemplation. And on a weekend like this, I was mentioning it to my wife, Carrie, and she's like, Tom, you gotta let the guys know, the husbands know, that this is like a perfect opportunity to give a gift to wives and mothers out there. You know, a lot of people think of January as the beginning of the year. A lot of moms who have school-age kids are thinking of September as the beginning of their school year. So there's a lot of planning that is leading up into it. And then they're launched September to June. And so this is the perfect window. You've got your college-age kids or, beyond college, they're home and available to watch the kids for a weekend. Give your wife or go as a couple an incredible gift of being able to come away. And in coming away to the beautiful setting of the South Hill of Spokane, the Immaculate Heart Retreat Center, huge opportunity to explore what, Dr. Lillis, you've been mentioning, which is a time of silence, a time of solitude, beginning to taste and to nurture a contemplative approach to prayer. You, in your website, beginning to pray, give a lot of practical tools and ways for Catholics to approach different forms of prayer, including contemplative prayer. Talk about the gift that a retreat is, and this retreat that you'll be leading coming up in just over a week, that it gives them the ability to come apart, to be attentive and to seek the face of the Lord, to encounter the Lord in times of silence and prayer.
Sure. You know, the word retreat is kind of the English word for it. Greek, the word is to withdraw to the desert. Anachoreson, our word anchorite comes from it. Anachoreson is to withdraw into the desert. And this is what Christians did from earliest times. We have, the life of St. Anthony of the Desert, who withdrew into the desert. And when you withdraw in the desert, you withdraw there to have intimacy with Christ. But you also withdraw. There's a lot of spiritual battles that happen in the desert, and things that we need to face as human beings that block our pathway to maturity. and that Jesus wants to help us with. And this is the whole battle of contemplative prayer, is a battle for truth, the truth about who I am and what I need to deal with and where God, Christ Jesus, is leading me. And so you're right that this is a singular blessing. No one who comes on a retreat is the retreat. For no one is it simply an accidental moment that they, you know, chanced upon. It's part of the eternal plan of the Father for your life. And so if you feel a prompting to go, that's likely the Holy Spirit inviting you to withdraw from the workaday world, from the exigencies of the moment, from the circumstances that normally drive you, to withdraw from those things and to listen to the still small voice of God. And in that vulnerable place where you're listening to him, God has some things that he's yearning to share with you. Blessings that he wants to bestow on you. And can you get those blessings at another time? Could you put God off? And yeah, but the blessings he has for you on this retreat are blessings that he will never offer you again exactly the same way. Someday, if you resist the grace of this retreat and just say, no, this isn't for me right now, I'll, you know, put God off for another time. God will bless you in the next retreat. But the blessings that he will give you on this retreat, if you choose to go, are blessings that will never come again in your life. And if you say yes to them, they will set your life in a certain trajectory. And that trajectory is absolutely beautiful and meaningful. It's a blessing that Christ yearns for you to have and for you to know. And so I hope that you will take this time. Take the time to go into the silence, to go into spiritual battle, but also, and most importantly of all, to draw into intimacy with the Lord so that he can share with you the beautiful treasures he's been waiting to give you.
Dr. Lillis, that's beautiful and profound what you just shared. Folks, I'm not sure, you just heard an incredible expression of spiritual theology, right? So often today we can consider theology to be very rational and abstract and simply focused on like the content of faith, as compared to spirituality that is sometimes reduced to fostering certain experiences of faith. And there's this kind of divergence between spirituality and theology. But if you heard carefully what Dr. Lillis just shared, he shared that coming away on retreat, it's a powerful means for you to discover your identity and God-given purpose, that there's going to be a battle, not only on retreat, but there might very well be a battle for you to get to the retreat. Do you think that the devil in the realm of the demonic has any interest in you setting down the tools of daily labor and what Anthony referred to as the exigencies of daily life? And we all have reasons why we would choose to crowd out the invitation that the Lord is making to come away. And there, what I just heard Dr. Lillis say is there's something at stake in this moment, right? You might have stumbled into this radio program, stumbled into this podcast, but it's a moment of grace. It's God's providence. It's not just a stumbling. No, it's the hand of the Lord guiding. And so it is going to be up to you to discern, well, what am I supposed to do with this? And if it's to come away on the retreat, it's August the 8th to the 10th, Friday evening to Sunday afternoon. It very well could be one of those transformative moments, a gracious disruption of the path you're on to discover more intimately and profoundly who you are in him, and to discover that eternal plan for which God has planted you in this moment. Again, powerful, powerful thoughts, Dr. Lillis. And so again, IHRC.net, IHRC, immaculateheartretreatcenter.net, where you can register for this retreat. Dr. Lillis, the retreat is on St. Elizabeth of the Trinity, Called to Glory, Spiritual Insights from St. Elizabeth of the Trinity. And you talked about identity, you talked about name. And that's where I think of when I think of St. Elizabeth of the Trinity. I have to tell you real just quickly, I discovered her in 1984 when she was just Sister Elizabeth of the Trinity. There was a book in English that a fellow seminarian gave to me and said, hey, you've got to read about this nun. And I just remember being so struck by the emphasis on the Trinity dwelling within, on the name that God revealed to her, which would be her heavenly name. We'll get into all of this. But I also remember she had like a interview questionnaire that she had to give answers to when she was going to enter the Carmel. And I still remember one of the questions was something like, what's the most important beatitude? And it was, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. And this book goes on to reflect on the power and importance of purity of heart in her life. So I have had a personal sense of devotion to her and sought her as an intercessor from the mid-80s. I had her somewhat to myself until all of a sudden John Paul II had to go and ruin it for me and expose her to the whole world by making her blessed and then a saint. I'm just kidding. But I have had a warm sense of affection for Sister Blessed, now Saint Elizabeth of the Trinity. But before I let you just respond to that, tell folks who are listening who have no awareness of who she is, tell us a bit about St. Elizabeth of the Trinity and then how you discovered her or whatever else you think is important to share.
Well, St. Elizabeth of the Trinity, just to kind of start out, even though she's in America, we haven't heard of her very much. She's probably influenced the church, especially contemplatives in the church, but the church universally in our devotion to the Trinity more than any of the other books that were written from the 19th and 20th century. I think that's likely true. She's the only 20th century mystic now canonized, but when she was quoted, she wasn't canonized. The only 20th century mystic quoted in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. She's in paragraph 260 under the heading of the ultimate end of the divine economy. And her insight is that what we will have the fullness of in the life of glory, that perfect unity with the Holy Trinity, is something that begins now. It's not a remote future possibility for our lives. It's something that we're meant to enjoy now. And contemplative prayer is the way to access that gift. So the Catechism actually quotes the first part of her prayer, "Oh my God, Trinity, whom I adore, help me to forget myself entirely, in order that I might be established as still and as peaceful as if my soul were already in eternity." And so what does that have to do with the devotion to the divine persons? Her idea is that she calls the Trinity my three, my all, my beatitude. Her idea is that the Trinity is already dwelling in us in the same way, substantially the same way that the Trinity will dwell in us in the life to come. But we need to believe in that. We need to take time to receive that, to welcome that reality, and we need to choose to live out of that reality. And so that's maybe a nutshell of her message. She said before she died, one of the sisters asked her, well, you know, Saint Thérèse of Lisieux, you know, before she died, she was told that she had a spiritual mission. You know, will you have a spiritual mission? And she said, no, when I die, I'm going straight into the bosom of the Trinity and just to praise his name forever. And then she said, well, maybe I do have a spiritual mission. And she later articulated it. And she said, after I die, my mission will be to draw souls into deep silence, out of themselves and into deep silence, so that in that deep silence, they may be touched or impacted by the Holy Trinity and transformed into him. And so she's talking about a transformative form of prayer that is stamped by the divine life. And moreover, she's interceding for those who are listening to this. She's already interceding for you so that you might know that kind of prayer. And it begins with a forgetfulness of yourself so that you can be completely vulnerable to God. That's what she's praying for right now for you. And she's helped many, many saints and mystics of the 20th century discover the same truth, receive the same grace.
You know, Dr. Lillis, the way that you talk about her is, it's very moving, because you talk about her as if there is a knowing and being known by her, a sense of personal connection and a sense of, oh, let me tell you about what this friend will do for your life, because I've hung around this friend and I see how this friend has influenced others. Folks, I want you to hear that the saints in heaven aren't simply like statues and photos and we just will throw a prayer their way in the hopes that somehow God will make it known to them so that they can pray for us. No, there's something much richer. There's a communion with the saints, right? This communion of the saints that you speak about, that's very personal and warm. And it's something that the Lord has for all of us. And maybe for you, brothers and sisters, it will be discovering an invitation to have this type of intimate relationship with the Lord, but hand-walked, right, accompanied by a newfound relationship with Saint Elizabeth of the Trinity. That's very powerful. And maybe it's her and maybe it's another saint, but don't leave the saints on the sidelines as simply people who left writings to be read or whose lives inspired us. But no, there's living contact, communication, and communion with the saints. Is that too strong? You're a spiritual theologian, and you just heard me share there. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I think there is a communion of saints, and that they're very actively involved in our life in ways that probably exceed our imagination to be able to envision or properly explain. But just to shed a little bit of light on it, St. Paul says that nothing can separate us from the love of Christ, that Christ, by his death on the cross, has put the enmity that was between us to death. So if he's conquered death, and nothing can separate us from the love of Christ, and the saints right now who know Jesus, who've been following Jesus, are before the face of the Lord right now, they're filled with the love of Christ. So what can stand between the love of Christ that's in them and us? Nothing. Death has no more power over to be Christian is to believe that death has no more power over us, that even if we die, we live. And if we really believe that, that means we have friends in heaven right now who don't stop loving us because they've died, are not less effective because they're closer to Jesus. In fact, you know, I offer this to your listeners, to all of us. You know, in this life, we begin our spiritual mission before the Lord. We begin it. But this life is filled with passing things, and we're limited and we get tired. One day, Jesus is going to invite you into his face, into his presence. He's going to invite you to come before his face, and we will be judged for the things we've done and the things we haven't done. But if you believe in his name and you believe in what he's done for you and that his grace is enough for you, if you believe that, it prepares you for that judgment. And the work, when you believe that, he gives you work to do in this life. He entrusts souls to you in the form of your sons and daughters, your spouses, your parents, your friends. He entrusts souls to you. And those souls that are entrusted to you in this life, when you die and you come before the Lord and he judges you in the light of his mercy, that mission that you received isn't taken away from you, but entrusted to you even more. But now you no longer tire. Now you are filled with his love and his strength and his glory in a way that you've never known before. Now there are no obstacles to the love of Christ in you. And so you're able to love those who are entrusted to you even more. This is the way the communion of saints works. It's holy things exchanged among God's holy people. And the ones who are freest to exchange the most with us are the saints who've gone before us in the light of our faith, and all Christians have believed this for centuries. It's only in the last 500 years that there's some Christians who don't believe it. This is the normative thing that all Christians have always believed, that we're bound together in this communion of saints, and those blessings are poured out upon us in an extremely visible and beautiful way every time we go to Mass. But every time we pray as well.
You know, again, I'm talking with Dr. Anthony Lillis, and go to beginningtopray.com, beginningtopray.com, to discover more about the great gift of prayer in our Catholic tradition and how to do that, how to grow in our own prayer life, as well as his podcast, Discerning Hearts. And he's written three books, and two of the books I think are beautiful, just even referencing elements from the title, are the kinds of things that you may experience when you go on a retreat. It's climbing a hidden mountain. It's entering a secret garden. It's experiencing the fire of God, not only just falling from heaven, but surging from within. These aspects of scripture and our Catholic mystical tradition and tradition of prayer, I think are really beautiful and powerful ways to understand how we can come into some of the same graces that St. Elizabeth of the Trinity received, namely discovering her the name, her heavenly name, it being given to her from reading, you know, Ephesians chapter 1. But talk a bit about that. Talk a bit about whether it's the hidden mountain, the secret garden, the burning bush and the fire of God, or the coming to discover your own name. Talk about throwing a big question at you, right?
I just co-authored, it's not out yet, but on August 19th, I co-authored a book called Named for Glory. And I co-authored it with Julie Insler, who was a friend of Father Michael Glenn's, Julie Insler and Father Ignatius Schweitzer. And we touch on this idea, just to zero in on one thing, that the Lord has a very special name for you that he calls you by. And Elizabeth of the Trinity firmly believed that her name was revealed to her in the writings of St. Paul. As she was reading St. Paul's letter to the Ephesians, she discerned that the Lord had called her. She said, "St. Paul revealed to me that my name that by which I'm called is for the praise of glory." And so she would sign her letters, actually, Praise of Glory or Laudem Glorium. And so other sisters began to ask her, you know, could you let me know what my name is, you know? And so one sister asked her this, Elizabeth, at this stage of the game, she died of Addison's disease. She was born in 1880. She died in 1906. Addison's disease is a disease that we can treat now, but at the time they discovered the disease, they didn't know how to treat it. You're usually dead after about 2 to 3 months. She lived for over 8 months with the disease, which is unbelievable. She was in complete agony, and at the end of her life, she was falling in and out of delirium. Anyway, one of the sisters, when she was, you know, a little bit more cogent, said, you know, could you tell me what my name is? And Elizabeth said, I'll pray about it. And then she fell into delirium. And she came out of it, and she wrote to the sister, you know, your name is hidden in God. And, you know, could you please give this to Sister so-and-so, which she did. And then a few nights later, that same sister was in the room, and Elizabeth suddenly, who'd been in a coma, basically, all of a sudden comes out of the coma, grabs the sister's hand, and said, is that you hidden in God? And the sister says, yes, it was me. And she goes, you need to know that Jesus himself told me that that is your name. And that name will require your whole, it will require your whole lifetime to realize. The whole idea of receiving a name in prayer, the name by which God calls you, is a beautiful idea. Here, though, I guess what is a name? A name is a gift. It's the way God sees, when God calls you by a name, it's a truth about the way he sees you. And the way he sees you is the deepest truth of all. It's the deepest reality of who you are, is what God sees. It's how he summoned you into existence. So a name reveals a gift, the gift of your existence. But the name also reveals a task. Every time you received a gift from the Lord, it is also a task. And the task of your name is to do everything you can to receive the gift and to help that gift be realized in the limited time we have together. And so there are many other things that we could say, but notice in the story of the burning bush, you know, a couple things. Moses is called by God. God calls his name. And likewise, you know, and when he calls Moses, who is he calling? You whom I've drawn out of the water. You whom I've drawn out of the water. That's what Moses means. And he invites him to come close. And as he comes close, Moses sees the bush, and the bush is ablaze, but it's not being consumed. And this would be the last thing that I would say is that when you give your life over to receiving the gift that God has given you, when you allow that gift to become your task, it is true, fire will take your whole being, and you everything you thought was a certain way won't be that way anymore, because you were seeing with eyes subject to death. Jesus sees with eyes that have conquered death, and he's going to take you places that are unfamiliar, uncomfortable, and inconvenient. But you will not be destroyed. All the deepest truth, everything that is most tender, good, and holy about who you are as a human being won't vanish from the face of the earth, but actually it will be preserved in the fire of God. It will be held up. It will become radiant. It will shine with the glory of God. And this is the nature of these graces that the Lord gives us, the grace when he calls you by name.
That's so powerful, Doctor. I was thinking about what you mentioned in this intimate connection between identity and purpose, or the vision of who you are and what mission God has for you while you live life here on earth, but then it extends into eternity. And I think the scriptures bring it out. The catechism brings it out, right? Jesus, Yeshua, means God saves. Well, does his name identify who he is or what his mission is? And the answer is yes. Or I think of John Paul II and, you know, all is gift. In one way, our deepest sense of identity is gift. And what's our deepest purpose? Well, to be who we are, to be a gift. And yet it becomes so challenging for us to allow those two to remain intimately connected. And it seems to me that one of the insights you're bringing out is that unless we plunge deeper within, unless we take that journey within into the core of our being, where we can commune with the Blessed Trinity, and Saint Elizabeth gives us a path to follow, we will live a divided, fractured life. It won't be a sense of wholeness and completeness, and even here on earth, it won't be perfect, but it will be partial, and it'll be something that will continue to grow. So we only have a couple of minutes left. And so I just want to give you, again, Dr. Anthony Lillis is coming to the Spokane area to lead a retreat. And I'm hoping that just this little taste of what he has to share will encourage you to come to the retreat, August 8th to the 10th, Friday, 6 o'clock until Sunday at 1:00. And it's at the Immaculate Heart Retreat Center, ihrc.net, or go to the variety of websites where you can discover more about the richness of what he shares on his podcast, Discerning Hearts, on his website, beginningtopray.com. Also, spiritualdirection.com is another one. And then you can discover a Substack that he has as well, where he does some writing. So lots of different ways to benefit and be blessed by by what he has to share. So what would be a final word that you'd want to offer today, Dr. Lillis?
Oh, I am, again, so honored to get to meet you and to be part of this show that you're doing. I want to thank you for, taking the spiritual life seriously, and even having this kind of conversation is itself a grace. And I'm sure your listeners totally appreciate the gift that you're bringing them. In conclusion, Elizabeth of the Trinity, if you can come to this retreat, for me, she's been a great spiritual friend who's helped me grow in holiness through the years. And I have not been nearly as faithful to her as she has been to me. But that's the way our saints in heaven always are. They're so aware of our needs, and they want to help us. And they've left behind not only a beautiful witness of their lives, but sometimes they've left behind a beautiful teaching that can help us go deep into prayer. I have three seminarians right now who've just completed 30 days of prayer with the writings of St. Elizabeth of the Trinity. Tomorrow is their last day of their retreat, and we're going to meet for the final time. And to watch how these teachings have helped them encounter the Lord in a much deeper way, and how he has challenged them into the maturity of their manhood so that they can make a good decision regarding the vocation Jesus has invited them into. It's a beautiful thing to see in their lives. I'm hoping that this retreat that we're going to be offering on St. Elizabeth of the Trinity offers others the same opportunity to grow in silence, to hear the voice of the Lord, to be called to greater maturity, and to make that decision to follow him more closely.
Amen. That's Dr. Anthony Lillis joining me today on the program. Thank you so much for giving me so generously of your time and our listeners. Folks, again, I hope you'll be blessed in your own discernment of how to access the riches that the Lord is giving to us through Dr. Lillis. And if you can, please make it to that retreat coming up on August the 8th to the 10th. Dr. Lillis, thank you so much for taking time with me today. I really, truly appreciate it.
Dr. Kern, I'm very, very honored. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.